For those of us who grew up with that song, it is a great song indeed. Just one correction. I think, Jenny, you said Hank Hamstra. She meant Hank Smistra, because I see Hank Hamstra right back there. Did you have surgery this week? No, okay. It's not Hank Hamstra. I thought so, but then I started worrying. I missed something, you know? Yeah. Smistra, Hamstra. Yeah. No, get it. There's more in this text than we can possibly cover this morning. I just want to alert your attention to verses 2 through 8 and some of the, it's a masterpiece of literary artistry. In the first instance, if you count up how many lines there are 14 lines. In Hebrew literature, as we know, seven and its multiples have significance. They suggest completion, totality, perfection. Also, if you look at the lines, you'll notice that the first line is matched by the second. So you actually have, you'd have to look at this at home today, but test it out, that you have seven doublets, which is pretty cool. Each line also is what literary scholars call a merism. A merism is a literary device where you aim to express a totality. So there is a time for birth, there is a time for death. You mention things at opposite ends of the spectrum in order to capture everything in between as well. A time for mourning, a time for dancing, and all the little experiences we have in between. So it's a very rich text that communicates literarily as much as it does by its language. I'm going to pick it up for us at verse 9. So after the times, we heard that through the birds. Beloved, listen to the rest of God's word in Ecclesiastes 3. I'm going to read through verse 22. What does the worker gain from his toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on human beings. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of humans. Yet they cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end. I know that there is nothing better for humans than to be happy and do good while they live, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in their toil. This is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will endure. Nothing can be added to it and nothing can be taken from it. God does it so that human beings will revere him. What is has already been. What will be has been before. And God will call the past to account. And I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. I thought in my heart, God will bring to judgment both the righteous and the wicked, for there will be a time for every activity, a time for every deed. I also thought, as for human beings, God tests them so that they may see that they are like the animals. Man's fate is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so dies the other. All have the same breath. Man has no advantage over the animal. Everything is chavel, meaningless, a breath. All go to the same place. All come from dust, and to dust all return. Who knows if the spirit of a human being rises upward and if the spirit of the animal goes down into the earth. So I saw that there is nothing better for a human being than to enjoy their work, because that is their lot. For who can bring them to see what will happen after them? The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. We, as creatures who live in time, just kind of take time for granted a lot of the time. It can be confusing. Time. You know, I love blondes, and I used to be a blonde before I got old, but the stereotypes are sometimes true. A blonde asked somebody, you know, what time it was, and they said it was 4:45. She got puzzled and scratched her head and said, you know, I've been asking people that all day, and every time I get a different answer. Confusing. Time can also be annoying. College student was showing a newbie around their dorm room, and they come into the main hall, and the new guy looks at the wall and he sees that there's this gigantic gong, brass gong with a hammer. And he says, well, what's that for? And the student said, well, that is our giant talking time clock. And he said, really? How does it work? He says, I'll show you. So he grabs the hammer and hits the gong. It's a loud, piercing sound. And from the other side of the wall, they hear, knock it off, you imbecile. It's 2 a.m. Kids, I got some for you as well. If 20 dogs run after one cat, what time is it? 20 after one. It's a groaner, isn't it?
I love it.
What time is it when you sit on a pin? Springtime. What time is it when an elephant sits on your car? Yes, time to get a new car. Friends, if any passage in Scripture is famous for its meditation on time, as Jenny said, it is the text before us this morning. It's Ecclesiastes 3. What is time, and in particular, what good is it for us to meditate on time? Well, Qoheleth, whom we are learning is our wise guide and teacher, is not going to give us some kind of philosophical or metaphysical meditation on time in Einsteinian fashion. He is not going to unravel that mystery for us, but he is going to do this. He's going to offer us a couple observations about time, and then he's going to show us that there's a problem. When you look at your own experience with these two observations, there's a problem. There's a conundrum that comes out of our experience of time. That, if we're going to be thinking and feeling people in the world, we've got to resolve. What he's then going to do is he's going to offer us resolutions to the problem that are available to us on the basis of our experience in this world. That's what wisdom literature does. It looks at the world and extrapolates what can be known on the basis of human observation and human experience. So how can we resolve the dilemma that time brings to us as human beings? By looking at our experience of this world. That's what Qoheleth's going to do with us. And I invite you to just walk with me through our text this morning. We have the gift of time, so let's use a bit of it this morning to look at this text carefully. Qoheleth's famous listing of the various things that happen in time, and that there is a time for in verses 2 to 8, is in the first instance simply a description of reality. If you live long enough, you will see that there is a time for the following events. There's a time to be born, there's a time to die. There's a time for dancing, there's a time for mourning. There's a time for war, there's a time for peace. If you live long enough, you will recognize that this is an accurate description of reality. These things simply happen, and all of the other little things in between them. But Qoheleth wants us to know, to look down into our own experience and recognize two other truths about this list, about the things that happen in time. And these two things are not going to be easily reconciled with one another, which is why, immediately after the list in verse 10, he's going to say that he has seen the heavy burden that God has laid on the sons of Adam, on human beings. These two things don't fit together well. Look at these two truths. First, Qoheleth says, it may be strange, but it is simply true that with each one of the sorts of things you find listed in verses 2 through 8, everything there's a time for, look, when they happen at the right time in the appropriate season, there is beauty in these things. There is. There's beauty in each and every one of these things on the list. Even the tough things, like hatred and war and killing, things you wouldn't really think that there is beauty in, but the beauty is there. Qoheleth urges us to recognize this first truth immediately in verse 1, though we seldom see it because of our translations. The NIV reads, "There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under heaven." But the Hebrew almost certainly says, there is a time for everything and a season for every delight or pleasure under heaven. The Hebrew almost certainly says this because in almost every other instance in the Hebrew Bible, when this word is translated, it is delight or pleasure. Furthermore, when you look at Hebrew lexicons, which I did for quite a while, at this word, either the translation activity is put at the very bottom in a few of them, or it does not occur as a possibility of translation for this word at all. For example, in the theological word book of the Old Testament, which is one of the big ones, it's not even an option. This word means delight. This word almost certainly means pleasure. The probability then that Qohelet wants us to consider the idea that everything in this list can be seen as a pleasure or delight or beautiful in its time becomes a great probability in verse 11. His list is completed, and then he says flat out, verse 11, he, meaning God, has made everything beautiful in its time. Everything is beautiful in its time. So the first truth we are to accept and to look at our experience to evaluate, friends, is that in life and in death, war and in peace, loving and hating, is that there is beauty and delight and pleasure in each and every one of these things, even the tough things. If we look at these items in wisdom, we'll see how it works, because again, that's how wisdom operates. And we can see that this is true, right? It certainly is. For example, on the easy side, a mother gives birth to a child and snuggles them near for the first time, and that is obviously beautiful. We all recognize that as beautiful. A loved one tells us of their love after 95 years of rich life and with a serene smile passes away in our arms as though they were passing away into the sweetness of sleep. The struggle is over. Yes, death is hard, but it's also potentially beautiful in its time to watch a loved one pass in perfect peace at a ripe old age. What about with planting and uprooting? Well, certainly we can see that planting can be beautiful. The Van Dykes or Hank Vandenbrink or Pat Stortebohm or Joe Vanderheiden or Hank Kickstra plant gardens. And it is beautiful if the time is right. You've been here around springtime, for example. And what about when they uproot? Well, that can be beautiful too. They take down a trellis that is full of weeds and rotten, and that's a beautiful thing because it's a beautiful thing to get rid of that which is ugly. What about killing? Can killing be beautiful, really? In its time, killing can be beautiful, absolutely. Like with Louis Pasteur, for example, who after many failed tries, finally finds the magic serum that will kill the deadly rabies virus and administers the drug that brings healing and life even while it kills. It's beautiful. And then, of course, we don't have time to talk about the doctor sitting with their patient bandaging their wounds, the sinner weeping at just the right time over their sin, friends laughing together until they cry, and the Amish community coming out as one person to weep and wail in an act of total solidarity with that community member who has suffered a loss in some way or another. It's beautiful in its time. All of them are beautiful in their time. And this is Qohelet's first truth. Pause. Can you see the beauty in even these tough things as well as the others? It's there if we look hard enough. Beauty flickers there. However, as Qohelet wastes absolutely no time expressing immediately in the next breath in verse 11, setting these two things in opposition next to one another, there is another truth to be seen. And namely, we must see that within the sweep of these events, with all of their bubbling and strange beauty, when it's evaluated in a total way from the vantage point of our total lives, as far as we can see them, and many of our feelings, all of this beauty at the very same time can become ugly. All of it. And why? Well, it's because, says Qohelet, quote, God has set eternity in our hearts, which is to say, we all have this strange sense within us, don't we? Unless perhaps we've been so scarred by life and hardened in some way. But we all seem to have this strange sense within us, a sense that is accentuated and inflamed precisely by our experiences of beauty and delight and pleasure, that despite all appearances to the contrary, How can we put this? Maybe death is, among other things, just unspeakably weird. Death is weird. Because we know that we were made for this world, to stay in this world for good, with one another and all the beauteous beauty within it for eternity. We have this sense. And so it's really kind of odd, actually, to depart. Because we do have eternity in our hearts. And yet we die. It all ends insofar as we can see. And the result of this dying, which if you read through Ecclesiastes, you'll see Colette is quite consumed with. The result of the dying, Colette now qualifies, is not, please, it's not that our lives and the beauty we've experienced obviously, objectively has no meaning. Notice how absolutely brilliant Colette is at this point, this inspired wisdom writer of God. The fact that we die, friends, and there is an apparent end of our time, does not mean, according to Colette, that our lives don't have any overarching transcendent meaning. But what it means is that we can't know if they have any overarching transcendent meaning. We can't know. And we can't know because, as Colette clearly sees, quote, we cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end. In other words, friends, precisely because we die, we arrive late, we leave early, we're here for some 70 to 90 years, our knowledge is slim. It's tiny, actually. And as a result, we cannot be sure of the true story of this world. Who are we? Where are we? What's the problem with this world? What's the solution? And what happens to us when we die? Is death the end? Notice how Colette will circle back round to this reflection in verse 21 of our text and the verses leading into it. Even though it looks, he says, like animals and humans all go to the same place after death and simply are both no more. There's a question mark for him. Are they no more, really? Or do human spirits, maybe, just maybe, ascend upwards as the eternity in our hearts awakens so powerfully by our experiences of beauty and pleasure and delight might indicate? We can't know. And for Colette, that is the most frustrating thing. It's the epistemological thing. It's that we can't know. That's an important question. Do you survive after you die? Don't know. You can't tell. Not on the basis of our experience, we can't tell. And that is Colette's second truth. So you see the two truths here and how they do not indeed fit together too well in Colette's mind. On the one hand, and somewhat strangely, we human beings experience beauty in all things, even strange beauty, and all the delight and pleasure that accompanies it as we march through the reality of what happens in time. And these experiences seem to indicate a transcendent purpose, a purpose beyond the ugliness, a meaning beyond the ugliness, like we were designed to be here for eternity. But on the other hand, we die, the beauty ends, and death looks like the end, and we cannot frustratingly say definitively that this isn't the end, but only that we don't know. And this situation can indeed make everything look absolutely ugly. And we can see this, can't we? Just contemplate the list again from this perspective. There is an overshadowing deeper ugliness in the beauty when looked at from the perspective of our impending deaths and our inability to know what happens to us after that. A mother gives birth to a child and there's so much beauty there, but it's actually ugly when you consider, as the atheist Christopher Hitchens once did, and put it so graphically, that given the long view of our lives, really what we can see happening is that that child is shot from its mother's womb as though from a cannon toward a barn door laced with spikes, where it will meet its bad end. Hitchens says, what's the point? Life in this case is actually only ugliness disguised. And we might agree. And in the same way, a loved one may pass on in peace, and that may be strangely beautiful. But if our love is strong,